Welcome to this webinar from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of B2B marketing professionals and people interested in B2B marketing. It's run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers. We provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for B2B marketers. And today, we have over 1,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, you're very, very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's really good to have you along again. This is the 10th week that we've been running these webinars on how B2B marketers are responding to the COVID-19 crisis. The macro trend impact so far has been huge. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has warned that the US economy could easily contract by 30% in an economic downturn that may last until late 2021. More people are seeking work. Unemployment numbers in the UK have soared to 2.1 million by the end of April. The financial impact of the coronavirus is hitting poor nations hard, with the World Bank warning that 60 million people are at risk of extreme poverty. Elsewhere, there are signs that the Western world is relaxing lockdown. Greece is announcing plans to allow visitors from other European countries from the 1st of July. In Germany, Bundesliga football matches resumed behind closed doors on Saturday. So how are our four speakers today seeing the impact of the crisis on them, their business, their projects, their working practices, jobs, marketing messages, marketing channels, and their profession? We'll hear from them shortly. As you listen, type a question or comment into the questions box, starting your point with the first name of the speaker that you'd like to address it. And I'll put your questions and comments to the speakers after we've heard from each. If you represent a business that has a B2B marketing project or role that you'd like to ask for help in filling from the community on this call, drop some details in the questions box and I'll mention it at the end of this webinar. Please also flag in the questions box if you'd like to be a speaker at a future COVID webinar, write about this one, or find out more about the BMC, and I'll be back. You can tweet along to today's webinar using the hashtag B2B Lockdown. That's B2B Lockdown. So let's get started. Our first speaker today is Lisa Daniels, who is head of marketing at BT Enterprise. With over 15 years client-side design and marketing experience across consumer, SME, corporate and public sector audiences, Lisa previously worked on brands such as Sky, Vodafone and B&Q. And I have to say, up until about a moment ago, we couldn't actually see Lisa because we were struggling to get her camera working. And it's brilliant that in the nick of time, she has appeared. So Lisa, welcome to the webinar. And over to you.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for the warm welcome. And it would have been slightly embarrassing given what I do for a living if I couldn't get my webcam to work. So I'm really fortunate that you can all see me now. Hi, I'm Lisa Daniels and I look after corporate and public sector marketing for BT Enterprise. I guess the view I thought I would bring to today's session was really one about the future beyond the imminent impact of what we're all facing. I think it goes without saying that we've gone through quite a journey in the last sort of 3 months. We've had absolutely everything you could possibly imagine being disrupted, and we've had to really work in a really agile, collaborative way with the rest of the business to make sure that we're organising ourselves against what we need to do. I suppose in our line of work, we fundamentally provide businesses with solutions that they need right now more than ever. If anything, it's really amplified our narrative. So from a kind of core plan perspective, actually, we were quite I say fortunate in the respect that it's really relevant, but it meant that we had to make sure that we were taking a step back to look at how we were approaching businesses, because our business customers were a mixed bag of those going through different journeys and different times. So it hasn't been an easy process, but we have certainly held a very relevant role, which has been, you know, really challenging, but also exciting, and glad that we can help businesses in their current time of need. The bit on the future that I wanted to talk through was really focused about the dynamics that I think this will impact on the way we do business and the way we sell and ultimately the way we market. I think what the coronavirus crisis has done is amplify many sort of underlying truths that we've all known about. I think all of us, whoever's listening, will have had, you know, strategic investment in MarTech and the use of data and personalization tools and in the use of content and making sure that we're engaging with customers in that more sophisticated way. But I guess that's then hindered by the fact that we are all probably, if you're anything like us, also massively important in playing the role of supporting sales and driving good conversations. And when about 50% of your budgets and your resources and your sales conversations are taking place in live events, in personal interactions, that obviously presents a pretty major impact. But what it does do is it gives us the opportunity to focus on those longer term investments and the way in which we know that we should be approaching our engagement with our customers going forward. So things like driving a great digital experience, it's always the first thing to get put back because you're facing the now situation, and helping sales to drive the leads they need to drive. What I found quite interesting is the fact that marketers were more ready for this situation than sales, in the sense that most marketeers wanted to drive greater reach, greater engagement, look at new tools, look at new ways of doing things. I don't think sales ever put themselves in a situation where they couldn't any longer sit in front of their customer or prospect and have a meaningful conversation. So going through this journey with sales to help bring them into a generation where actually there are more than one way to engage with customers, and actually we already know what they are. We just never really had the free rein to be able to go after it and actually be able to implement some of those more sophisticated measures. The other thing that I think is really interesting, and I only really started working on large business and public sector marketing about a couple of years ago, I come from a very consumer background, was the way buying patterns and decisions didn't seem to move on the way that they have with consumers. You know, it's obviously not a transaction, so it's more of a complex, it's often more of a complex conversation. But actually, the way in which we deliver that and the way in which a business can engage with another business, it hasn't felt sustainable. And I've actually felt like this shakeup that this will present, and showing that you don't need to spend hours on the road traveling to and from each other to have lots of meaningful conversations, when actually you could deliver a great experience virtually and digitally, and then use those personal experiences to enhance it rather than it being at the core of everything. Now, what I think that does from a marketing perspective is it gives us an opportunity to do more for less. So it allows us to get a much greater reach. It allows us to use data and have a much more scientific approach to what we do. The other reason why I think it's important, and why it's, while it's super challenging right now, is the timing, really. We close to our hearts, 5G is here now, it's rolling out, the use of technology is getting more and more prevalent in everything we do, whether that's marketing or other things. But, you know, the use of 5G really does unlock the ability to use concepts like AI and AR and VR in our experiences to drive an enhanced, really hyper-personalized experience. And really, they've kind of been like proof of concepts to date, because no one's felt quite confident to really kind of go after it, because obviously we didn't necessarily have the infrastructure there. So my advice to everyone, whatever role you're in, whatever industry you're in, is to take a step back and look at all the things you knew that you wished you could do. Have a look at what the current situation is and think about how you can take this to actually overhaul all those things that you knew didn't feel quite right, didn't feel that efficient, probably weren't that well received by customers, if we're being really honest, and actually look at how you can wow them and how you can sort of actually use the use of technology to drive your business forward. So it's basically, while it's impacting on the short-term activities right now, I actually think it could be a catalyst for us driving the strategic development that we need for the long term, which will help us to use the concepts like 5G and the use of technology in our future activities. And I think without this being a catalyst, we were always going to be playing catch up. So I think look to the opportunity and just to take a step back about what your strategic approach is, and try and keep your one eye on the long term whilst you're dealing with the current crisis.
Lisa, that's brilliant and really good advice to end on. And thank you very much for joining us. I'm hoping that people on the call have got questions for you. If they do, they should start their question with your first name, Lisa, put it in the questions box, and we'll get through as many of those questions as we can after we've heard from all four speakers. Hashtag B2B lockdown if you want to tweet along to the webinar today. Our second speaker is B2B marketing strategist, LinkedIn specialist, and curious thinking advocate, Charlie Wyman. Charlie is host of the Curious Marketing Club and Curiosity Key podcast, and it's brilliant to have you here today, Charlie. Thanks for coming on, and over to you.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks so much for having me. I think I'm at the complete opposite end of the scale because I generally work a lot with sort of very small businesses, consultancy companies, and also individual consultants. And what I've found at the moment is, and to quote one of my clients from earlier today, they are paving the path for their future. And it's been so refreshing to see so many people, especially that I come into contact with, that are seeing this as an opportunity to promote their purpose, and an opportunity for them to really have a look at how they're marketing their business, what they're communicating to the world, and how their processes and systems are set up. A lot of what I talk about is, have less but better. So can you leverage more of the assets that you have right now? And looking at the assets as in the knowledge of your team, one of the biggest battles that I used to face when I used to work, because I worked as the head of marketing for a group of companies, and then prior to that I was the head of sales and marketing for a global systems integrator, was that one of the biggest assets of the companies is the knowledge, the skills, and the experience of the team. And that went way beyond the marketing team. And what I'm seeing is that, especially some of the companies that I deal with, that they are really working on leveraging that knowledge. So their sales teams that can't go out and deal directly with customers, they're writing articles, they're running webinars, they're engaging with clients and prospects in a slightly different way that can then be used again and again in the future. So when I talk about paving the path for the future, is have a look at the opportunities that you have in front of you, have a look at the knowledge and the experience that you have in your head, and what can you get out of your head, and put out into the digital space. Because a lot of people are signing up to webinars, they're joining online events, they're wanting to engage with suppliers. So even though they may not be ready to spend money right now, they want to have those meaningful conversations, and they want to start laying those foundations so that when things do, go back to normal, they can then progress those conversations further. And I think as well, like, online events are such a huge thing, and there's so many different things that you can do with that. And I think I deal with a lot of accountants. My week has actually been spent talking to a lot of accountants and SaaS companies that are targeting accountants. And the common theme is that at the start of the COVID crisis, a lot of accountants were being heavily relied upon by their clients, and they were sort of scrambling at the bit, and they were, they didn't have time to think about anything else other than dealing with the crisis. Whereas now they're having a look at how they're spending their time, having a look at, right, it's not sustainable to be constantly having one-to-one demonstrations with people, one-to-one sales conversations, and actually looking at, right, okay, how could I do this as a one-to-many model? What can I set up as a live webinar? What could I set up as an evergreen webinar? How can I leverage things like YouTube? Because for a smaller business, especially when you're reining in your marketing budget, you need to have a look at what you can leverage and what you can use for free. And there are so many free tools around there that you can use. One of my favorite tools I've been using for well over a year now is otter.ai. So for anybody here that's never used Otter, because it gets better, it's a free tool that you can just upload your webinar, and it will give you a full transcription. So if you're handling Q&As all the time, or if your clients are asking you the same questions over and over again, you know, transcribe them, publish them on your website as a blog or an FAQ section, cut it up into snippets and host it on a YouTube channel. You know, there's so many different ways that companies can leverage what they've got in their heads and what they're doing at the moment. And I'm finding it really exciting because I'm very much a glass half full sort of person. I spend a lot of my time with clients that are that way inclined. And, you know, I think that those clients that are taking up the opportunity, they are being visible and they're looking at how they can communicate their purpose and their drive. It's really paying off for them. And that's the feedback that I'm getting on a daily basis by people. Not just, you know, Zoom fatigue, you know, which is a real thing. And that's why I've got these stupid glasses on, because they're blue light glasses. So anybody watching this that just thinks Zoom fatigue is a real issue for me right now, I'm sick of staring at my computer at home, get yourself a pair of blue light glasses, because they're amazing.
I can back that up, actually. I'm doing exactly the same thing myself. Charlie, thank you very much. If you've got questions for Charlie or if you've got questions for Lisa, do ping them through to us and we'll try and get to them at the end of hearing from all of our speakers. Hashtag B2B lockdown if you want to tweet along. It's time now to get your views with our first poll that can be accessed by anyone who's taking part in this webinar on a computer. This one's hopefully teeing our third speaker up, we'll see. It's all about your marketing plan. And the question is, do you have a plan for how your business is marketing through this crisis? And there are five options. Yes, yes, but we're adapting it as we go. Yes, but we're reviewing it regularly. Not yet, we're still working on it. Or no, we're taking each day as it comes. And please start voting now, and we'll take a stock of that in a moment or so. If you voted already, why not ask a question to either Charlie or to Lisa, and we'll get those questions to people after the end of hearing from our speakers. Or why not tweet along a hashtag B2B lockdown. We'll give the voting a bit longer and then we will take stock. We'll give it 10 seconds more and then we'll stop the poll. Cool, there we are. So let's stop the poll and take stock of what we've got. So encouragingly, 51% of you have got a plan, but are reviewing it regularly. The next highest number, 29%, have a plan, but were adapting it or are adapting it as you go. There's just under 10% of you still working on a plan. 6% saying this isn't a time for plans. We're going to take each day as it comes. I'm hoping that's good input for our third speaker. John Webb is the managing director for Dennis Publishing's demand generation business, Nows. John previously led B2B marketing at companies including Samsung, Rackspace, and Yahoo. And as well as his experience in B2B marketing, he's also an expert on implementing and using agile practices in marketing teams. John, welcome to the webinar and over to you.
Thanks, Dave, and hi, everybody. That was really interesting, that poll, actually, because I think you could actually make an argument for each of those. I don't think any of those is necessarily the wrong answer. And I think that really talks to what I just wanted to touch on, which is this agile approach. And agile marketing. Anybody that has heard me before or seen me in one of these sessions knows that you know, I've implemented agile marketing in a number of companies now, either as the you know, marketing lead or as a consultant. And I think that agile as a concept, not only for the business but for marketing specifically, has never been more relevant. What we've seen in the last year is that even before this crisis, a lot of companies were starting to adopt agile within their marketing teams. So there's an annual State of Agile Marketing report that comes out. The latest one just came out in April, and it showed that it's moved from 32% of marketing teams being agile to 42% in the last year. So we're seeing a big shift, and it's now become actually the dominant model that teams are applying when it comes to how they are operating. And I think what's really interesting as well in terms of those results is if you look at the reasons why people are adopting agile, and the number two reason, which is just behind the increase in productivity, was because people see that it enhances the ability to manage changing priorities. And that's never been more the case than this point in time. With everything that's happening in the world, everything is moving so fast, everything is changing so fast, it's really difficult to keep up. It's really difficult to know where we should be focusing, where our clients are going to be, never mind in 6 months' time or in a year's time, but tomorrow. And you know, definitely within Dennis, we felt that. A big part of our business is automotive. And we all know, and we've seen the data in terms of what's happened in the automotive sector, which, you know, car sales have gone from you know, a lot to none overnight for the last few weeks. So, you know, we are very much at the forefront of that kind of change. And so I just really wanted to talk about kind of three things that Agile brings. And I think to kind of give it a bit of, when I'm talking about Agile marketing, a lot of companies are now adopting Agile in many different departments, marketing being one of them. But it is different, okay? You can't just lift and shift the Agile approach that, you know, the dev team, the product team, the IT team use and drop it into marketing. Marketing is different, it has nuances, it has different cultures, but there are a lot of principles behind Agile that make sense. And I've seen time and time again work. And I think especially at this point in time, can help marketing teams really, really maximize what they're doing, both on a day-to-day basis and in terms of those long-term plans and long-term strategies. So three things. Number one, it's crucial at this point in time that we have rapid information flow. There's so much happening, there's so much changing. It's really important that as marketers, as marketing teams, we have, you know, sight on what is going on. And so what Agile enables you to do is build in those processes and build in those systems that enable you to have that information flow. So two things that we do and we have at Dennis. Number one, we have daily stand-ups. So every day there's a touch point where the team's coming together. It's 15 minutes. We're doing it virtually. You know, we're doing it via Google Meet. But what it enables us to do is not only catch up with each other, but also share any learnings that we've had over the last 24 hours. That combined with the tools that we use. So one of the big tools that we use is Slack. And we have specific channels that we've created in Slack where not only are the marketing team sharing new information, but we're doing it across teams. So we have channels where the sales team are inputting. So one, for example, is where the sales team, they're often getting nuggets of information from clients, whether it's on a call or a meeting or whatever, and they put those in that Slack channel. And one of the things that came out of that very, very early in this crisis was the move of clients to virtual events. So what we saw in the B2B space is that a lot of our clients were not able to go to physical events because those events weren't happening, or they were sponsoring those events and therefore those sponsorship budgets were now becoming available. We picked that up very, very early. And what that enabled us to do was move our product offering to meet that need. So we developed a virtual events suite of products and propositions that we went to market with that is now one of our leading revenue streams from our B2B business point of view. The second thing is rapid iteration of plans. So like I say, things are changing so quickly, there's new information coming in, and it's really difficult to think about those long-term plans and long-term strategies without taking into consideration how the world is changing. So what Agile does is it basically chunks up your longer-term strategies so you absolutely understand what it is that you're focusing on in the here and now that is ultimately working towards those strategies. So one of the big myths about Agile and Agile marketing is that it means you don't have a strategy. It absolutely the other way around. You have a strategy, but it's about how you operate that and how you make it happen. So for example, one of the things we're now doing is, we've moved to literally weekly sprints. So we're having a weekly sprint cycle where we chunk our strategies up into weekly iterations, and we're working on those. And then we come back at the end of the week, we feedback, we build that into our plans for the following week. And what that enables us to do at this point in time is move very, very quickly and develop things very, very quickly. Another thing that we use as part of this iteration is instead of having really long documents, you know, tons of PowerPoint slides talking about marketing strategies and plans, we use canvases. So you might have come across the business model canvas. There's a lot of canvases that you can use out there for things like persona development, for creating marketing plans, for mapping customer journeys. A little bit of a plug, if you go to the website get2growth.com with the number 2, you'll find a load of templates on there for all kinds of things that will help you with your marketing. But the key thing is they're all on one page. So they're light, they're flexible, and they're fluid, which means you can change them very, very easily and very, very quickly. What that means is you can iterate. So you're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but as you get new information, as you find you get results, as you don't get results, you can iterate those plans and then move them and progress them forward. So rapid iteration of plans. The third thing that combines the first two is then rapid experimentation. So one of the key concepts behind Agile is the idea of product and dev world, minimum viable product. So I want to rephrase that to you as marketers, is think about minimum viable campaigns or minimal viable programs. There's a lot of risk at the moment. And you know, we are also being charged with, a lot of us, reduced marketing budgets. So how do you optimize that? And by being able to move quickly and put things to market and get rapid feedback, you're able to really understand what's working and what's not working. So the concept of developing minimum viable is key. One example that we've done is we saw a need in our portfolio for more of a pure play business decision maker brand. So we had a number of brands like IT Pro, for example, which tailors IT decision makers. But we wanted something to sit alongside that was focusing on business decision makers. Now, at this point in time, we don't have the time and resource to go out and create a whole new website or anything like that. So we came up with the idea of creating a digest. Very popular at the moment, kind of long form informational emails, newsletters that go out on a weekly basis. We came up with a completely new brand for this, which is called the Business Briefing. So if you go to thebusinessbriefing.co.uk, you'll be able to see it. But essentially, it's all kind of business-oriented news, and it's aggregating all business content from across the different Dennis websites into one space. We literally that was from concept to launch with full branding and everything in 3 weeks. That meant that we could get rapid feedback, we could understand what was actually happening, what the response to that was, and then double down. So that approach means that you can test things, get feedback, optimize your spend, minimize your risk, and move forward. So these three things have really, really helped Dennis specifically, and within Dennis, our marketing team. It's really about how do you still have that long-term plan, but how do you work it backwards to understand what is it you need to be doing here and now, especially in the context of everything that's going on in the world and how it's changing. So there's a lot you can pick up and a lot you can learn about Agile. And I just think it gives companies the edge at this point in time to be able to really be attuned to their customers, to attune to their markets, and to be able to deliver operationally the strategies that they've developed.
John, thank you very much. I can't believe people are going to let you get away without asking you any questions. If you've got any questions for John on Agile, do ping them through. Lisa's controversially talking about marketing being ahead of sales. Do you agree? Ping some questions through to Lisa. And Charlie is talking about the opportunities to really take stock. So what thoughts do you have about the best ways of being able to do that? I hope you'll be pinging questions through for Charlie, Lisa and John. Hashtag B2B lockdown if you want to tweet along. And we get now to our second poll. This one's slightly different. This one's about your personal working hours. It asks the question, and here you, all of the options are viable for you to click. So you can click as many options as you like. What has been the impact of the COVID crisis on the hours that you work? And click all of the options that work for you. Either my working circumstances have changed compared with before the crisis, i.e. I've been furloughed, or maybe projects have fallen through. So that's been my focus. Or alternatively, I'm by choice, I'm working fewer hours than before the crisis, or I'm working the same number of hours as before the crisis, or working more hours than before the crisis. And then a question about productivity. I'm being more productive in my working day now than before the crisis. So how many of those options apply to you? And we'll give you a moment or two to click on the ones that are relevant. And whilst you're voting, don't forget to ping questions through to Lisa, to Charlie, or to John. Don't forget to join our hashtag B2B lockdown. Right, we're coming up to the 1 minute mark. So let's stop the poll there and see how things look. And you can see 54% of you are working more hours now than before the crisis. 39% of you, though, in contrast, are saying that you're more productive in your working day now than before the crisis. So there's a slight difference there between those two numbers. 32% of you are noting that working circumstances have changed for you compared to how things sat before all of this kicked off. Maybe that will be food for thought for our fourth speaker. Smart Marketing Reports, Vernon Riley. Vernon is a chartered engineer who helps marketers achieve measurable marketing by sorting out bad data and reporting. Vernon, welcome to the webinar, and over to you.
Thank you, Dave. Sorting out marketing tracking at the moment is, I have to say, being treated as a discretionary spend. So it's a bit quiet. Right, if you put up with bad data for years, why sort it now, kind of thing. But I expect things will pick up as people discover the merits of making the best of what they have when they haven't got money. So, but what I thought would be worth doing is considering how the broader economy could change. And I want to throw some controversy in here, because I think there are some big assumptions being made. I was, as I say, a chartered engineer, and I learned in that how assumptions allow you to solve problems, but you have to ask what happens if the assumptions are invalid. It helps me in my work, and it's important looking at this crisis, it seems to me. Most of the current comment has accepted the fact that the old normal won't return. But I'm concerned how few are openly considering how many big assumptions might get swept away. And this afternoon, I want to think about the idea of invoicing for marketing services, investing in order to produce a return. Lockdown, we agree, hasn't got a precedent, right? So why should the economic consequences of the recovery be anything like that of recessions we remember? There are sectors completely shut down, consumers spooked. Now, I'm not here to suggest everything's back or I've got a private black cloud that I want to share, but I think we need to look hard at what the potential side effects are and what we might have to do to recover. I've wondered what we could learn from more distant events like the Great Depression. And my thoughts have been inspired by this book. It's The Other Half of Macroeconomics. It's by a guy called Richard Koo. He's the head of Nomura Research and one of the leading macroeconomists, if I can say it. The big assumption that most economists make is that borrowing in the expectation of profit just happens. You know, it's kind of like just happens every day. And in general, individuals save, but private businesses and capitalists will borrow and invest for profit. And borrowing for profit would seem to underpin all marketing activity. It's why you would invest in marketing to try and improve the revenue and profit in the medium and longer term by doing things today. But as Richard Koo points out, there are circumstances when businesses don't borrow. And he coined the term balance sheet recession. It's the other half of macroeconomics, the things that the economists don't generally think about. And there are two reasons he considers why borrowers fail to appear. One is there's nothing worth borrowing money to do. That's a relatively easy one to think about, and there can be answers to that. But the more difficult one, and the one that we might face, is no lender's going to advance the funds because the borrower is too weak to create the confidence that the borrower could ever pay the lender back. And that's what happened after the Great Depression. It happened in Japan in the late 90s. Consumers saved, businesses saved, no one borrowed. And what then happened was we got deflation and stagnation. The money in circulation dropped. Now, we haven't had quite that happen here recently, but quantitative easing didn't do what the Bank of England thought it was going to do. The money supply, the amount of money in circulation, has stayed relatively flat. Now, back to where we are. We are learning, Rolls-Royce today, that there isn't the isolation between B2B and B2C that we might thought there was. You know, 9,000 people are learning today that the gas turbine supply chain has been impacted by the fact that people can't fly on holiday to Spain. Lots of businesses are leaking cash rapidly. Balance sheets are getting hammered, and that'll make it difficult for people to agree to lend. So what then happens? So you make a case for investing in marketing. And the response might be, it would have been a good business case pre-COVID-19, but the business is now too weak to borrow or spend the money to take it forward. Now, if you're working for an agency and that's a common response, it's a big problem. Could be a good case, logical, gets turned down. If you work for a company that feels that way, it's also a big problem. So if investing in marketing becomes outdated, a concept from a previous era, what can we do about it? What can we as inventive marketers who want a recovery, who want to do things, do? And it seems to me the core problem sits with the transactional model. It's the assumption that people will pay before the return happens. If one paid far less until the reward was evident, then much less borrowing would be required. Now, changing to that fuller risk sharing model causes a huge readjustment. Legal costs and all sorts of things have to change. The timings of cash flows, but, and here's the kicker, maybe that would be a better outcome, a silver lining. Marketers would have to stand behind the risk that their initiative might or might not work. They'd have to be part of the risk, the agency and the client. If it did work out, they get paid the full risk premium for having had that confidence, and the proportion of the resulting revenue or profit would come to them, unrelated to the costs. So maybe that's the kind of offer to start thinking about. What happens if the cash that we've got now, that corporates are continuing to have at the moment, decreases over the next few months, and we get to a situation where investing becomes difficult for financial reasons, not because of logic. So this is but one scenario, right? There'll be lots of scenarios out. And what I wanted to do this afternoon was simply say, look hard at the assumptions. I don't think people generally are looking hard enough to work out what might get broken, what might change beyond all recognition. Over to you, Dave.
Vernon, thank you very much. So it's down to marketers to take a bit more of the risk and the responsibility for what they do, says Vernon. If you want him to get away with that, don't ask him any questions at all. But I suspect that you may want to challenge it, in which case, starting your questions over to Vernon. We also welcome questions for Lisa, for Charlie, and for John. Let's go now to our third and final poll of the afternoon. This one asks about working from home. It asks you not working from home now, because if you look at the latest data that came through from O2, I can see now Mark Larwood is on the call, so he'll be very grateful for me reiterating his research. 87% of people, I think, if my memory serves, are working from home in the UK right now, according to O2. The question we're asking is, how much do you think you'll be working from home when the crisis is over? And this one isn't multiple options for you to select. You can only pick one, not at all, only when you need to, once per week, several times per week, or permanently. And let's see how you see the future of working from home. And if you voted, why not ask a question for one of our speakers, and we'll get that over to them in just a minute. Or why not go to hashtag B2B lockdown. Okay, we're at a minute, so let's stop and let's see what we've got. So in terms of working from home for the future, several times per week is what 56% of you are saying the new normal will look like. 22% of you are seeing working from home permanently, whilst 19% are staying with only working from home when you need to, 3% not at all. So that's quite a result in terms of in favour of increased working from home, I think, going forward. Thank you for that. If you've got any comments or views on that, do ping them over to us and we will try and get to them. We've got some questions that are coming through now, and I'm going to start with a question for Lisa that comes from Lorraine Jenkins. Lorraine says that you mentioned events and how to fill the gap left by physical events. What innovation have you seen in the area of virtual events? And do you see physical events coming back by the end of the year, Lisa?
It's a great question. So I think the innovation of you in terms of virtual events is in its very early stages. I think it has heaps more potential, and this is definitely more Charlie's area of expertise than mine, but I think that there is plenty that could happen if we really think about what is it a live event gives us or our customers, and actually how do we replicate that in a virtual environment. So I think right now it's about taking the basics, making sure you deliver a really great conversation, an engagement, an opportunity to network, an opportunity to be in the room, if you like, with like-minded individuals, and giving your customers that opportunity. I think we in BT, we've obviously quickly morphed our what would have been live events into digital ones, and we're already seeing a greater attendance, greater engagement, and actually great feedback. And it is really making us think, actually, really, you know, these events are quite limiting from a geographical point of view or from a from an attendance perspective. It's now giving more and more people the opportunity to come and engage with you. So I think that there's plenty more in that space, and I'm really excited to see what those providers bring and what concepts you will have as well. I'd really like to hear them. Back to physical events, will they come back by the end of the year? I'd be surprised, if I'm being honest. I think there's an awful lot of risk, I think, on all parties involved. And actually, if we get some great success in getting some traction in moving these things away from being those live events, hopefully when we can all get back together again, it can be in a more meaningful, so it's more quality over quantity. So maybe some small events, you know, maybe that would be appropriate, but I can't see large scale exhibitions and events. I personally can't see them ever returning in the same format that they've been existing in. And I think that's actually been quite unsustainable for some time. And this is just driving a bit of a catalyst towards that.
Wow. Say what you think, Lisa.
Always.
Let's go to a question for Charlie. This one from Jamie Hirschfield, who is asking, what was the name of the transcribing software? I think it was called Otter. Is that right? I can't hear you.
don't want you to all hear my baby screaming outside, who is with his dad, by the way, just because anybody would think I've left him outside on his own. It's called Otter, like the animal, OTTER.AI. There is a paid tool, and if you are not a fan of writing and you're keen to get involved in blogs, there's a really cool phone app that you can get, so you can talk. So if you have a topic that you want to talk about it, record it on your phone, and then Otter will provide you with the transcription. I use it for my podcasts to create the show notes because it's timestamps and everything. So for webinars and things like that as well, it's great. And they've invested quite heavily into it as well. And especially, I mean, that's a company that's benefited massively from this situation because loads of people are using it or starting to use it.
Thank you. Some good tips there. Next question for John comes from Gigi Vachalava, and I'm going to paraphrase this question. I think Gigi is asking John how agile marketing can be applied to customer engagement or even winning a new customer.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, again, it comes back to, you know, firstly, making sure that you've got that information flow. So as you're looking at winning a new customer, making sure you've got the channel set up to build that learning. And I think one of the key things is there to do it institutionally. So a lot of the time what you see is that information sits in pockets. It sits in pockets in different tools. It sits in people's heads. So how do you take that information and put it together in a place that's shareable and consumable across the business? So, you know, some of the tools are used in Agile, should we say, and, you know, I mentioned Slack before, look at the Atlassian suite, Trello, things like that, enable you to essentially create repositories for that information. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing, coming back to kind of the processes and the ways of working, you know, when it comes to whether you're talking about specific customer or groups of customers, it's really, again, important to get that kind of iteration so that you can start building those learnings. So, you know, taking slices of time to be able to try different things, put plans in motion, see what kind of feedback you get, see what kind of results you get, what kind of data you get, and then using that to inform as you go forward. So how can you do that on an individual basis? We use it for account-based marketing, for example, where, you know, we're building that iterative cycle into the kind of the stuff that we're doing from an ABM point of view in terms of the campaigns that we're running and the tests that we're running to improve those ABM campaigns and those ABM processes as we're moving forward. So it's taking the principles of Agile and then looking at how, and it can be applied whether you're talking about retention of customers, whether you're talking about winning new customers, whether you're talking about entering new markets, whether you're talking about creating new teams. It's just how you apply it in those contexts.
John, thank you. We've got a question that is for everybody, but I'm going to direct it specifically at Vernon. This question, Vernon, comes from Nick Eads, and he says, he gives you the choice, working from home or sleeping in the office, discuss. And is this good for our social and mental well-being? Can we do our best work when we're at home, Vernon?
I would have said so. Probably better, right? You need social interaction, but you need it on an organized and controlled basis.
Okay.
What do the others think?
Does anybody else want to? Charlie, proper an opinion.
I'm going to weigh in some thoughts here because I've worked from home for years. I used to have to commute from Nottingham to Rotherham every day. So I used to work from home at least 2 days a week. Since I had a baby, I was so excited to join a co-working space and just go and just get out of the house so I could separate home life and work life. And I think the difference between people being productive at home is their ability to separate the two and also be quite disciplined. I find that if I shut myself away in my office, make sure that I get out to have a walk every day, then my productivity just goes through the roof. Whereas if it's like rubbish weather outside and I haven't gone for a walk, that does massively affect it, which I know is like kind of a bit broadcast and not everybody can use that. But I think it's all about creating habits. So if you are going to work from home, you need to have the right mindset, and you need to be engaged with both your clients and your team, and finding the right way that works for you, because the same way doesn't work for everybody. I used to manage a technical team, a marketing team, a sales team, and have a look at all of the different types of personalities. And it was impossible to find one way that worked for everybody. So it really does depend on who you're working with, would be my advice.
I think that's a really good answer. I'll proffer an opinion on this one, which is that I think it's the discipline that matters. Sort of jumping from what Charlie said, you can work anywhere you like, but you have to be disciplined, and you have to be disciplined in different ways. I think as I've moved to a situation where kind of I'm locked down here for 5 days a week, the thing I had to learn was how to be disciplined in an environment which isn't governed by train timetables and meeting schedules and those sort of things. And I hadn't really realized how much when I was working in the office, actually there were all these kind of subliminal time signals that were going on through the day that created the structure I needed. And so I'm finding that for now, it's about trying to create those similar sorts of structures, but working from home. John, Lisa, do you want to offer a view?
Yeah, I agree with all of what you've just said. And I think that, you know, the discipline and the structure is key. So do I think we can be just as productive at home? Yes. Do I think we can be just as creative from home and only from home? I'm not so sure. So me personally, I'm a very social being generally, and I thrive off interaction with others and not necessarily always planned interaction. So for example, if I'm ever working on a more creative task, I might take myself away from the space of the office I normally sit in, or go outside and work from somewhere else in central London. And not being able to take myself away from the environment and into another one to sort of just change my mind a bit, I think potentially could have an impact on creativity, definitely.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there are pros and cons. I do think one of the things about working from home is that it is actually easier to isolate yourself. So with the electronic world, it is easier in some respects to turn it off. Whereas in the office, if somebody comes up to you and, you know, it's shall we say, difficult to get out of that interruption. So working from home, you know, you can isolate yourself, which, you know, all of us, I think, need to make more time for that deep working. So being able to do that and carve that time out and actually isolate yourself, I think, is absolutely crucial. We mentioned tools before. One tool that I use is a tool called Momentum. And essentially what that is it gives you essentially a specific home screen on your browser. But one of the tools that's built into it is a Pomodoro timer. So what that enables you to do is essentially have kind of a 25 minute cycle where you focus on one task for that 25 minutes. And there's a lot of research and a lot of psychology that proves that by chunking up time like that, whether it's individually using a Pomodoro timer to do 25 minute stints or sprints in Agile, makes you much, much more effective, and you're much, much more likely to achieve more in that space of time.
Good advice there, thank you. Let's go to another question. Lisa, I'm sorry, this one, I used to work at BT, and whenever I was at a dinner party, I'd get asked like a question like this. Here it comes. It's from Andy McClure. And it says, Lisa, I can't get a decent 4G signal in Surrey or back in the day on a train. Why invest in 5G content if 4G isn't stable for my consumers?
Very fair point. The only answer I'm going to provide on that is that 5G unlocks models that 4G and 3G don't. So I do agree on a classic connectivity level. That, you know, the core network needs to be in place. And that's why we do continually invest in those technologies too. What 5G does is it really changes the game from being just a speed and data provider, really, of connectivity, and into something that allows you to make things like driverless cars and things that require you to have a very low latency in response to be able to do. So things like virtual reality couldn't really be possible with a 4G connection, even if it was everywhere. So yeah, we're not investing in other things, but the introduction of 5G is game changing in ways that many of us won't even know yet. So there will be a shift.
Thank you. And I should say Andy has come back, and maybe it was, maybe this is my fault. So Andy makes clear that this wasn't an aggressive question, but genuine concern about your experience. So I apologize if I misled you. Gigi Vashilov asked a question for Charlie. Lots of seminars, webinars, whatever circulated around. What would be the three specific signs to identify a webinar which would meet customer needs? What are the three things that we should consider to identify the right webinar or seminar?
So just to clarify that question, is that for you to identify a webinar for you to participate in, or for you as a marketer to market your webinar so that it's appealing for other people to register and join in?
I don't know, but I'm going to suggest we take the second of those. Yeah. So how to market the webinar for your customers.
It's a great question. I did a training on this afternoon in my marketing club, actually. What are the chances? I know for me, this is the huge opportunity for companies to really differentiate themselves and to stop adding to the noise that's online at the moment. Especially in the industries that I work in, so more technical industries, a lot of webinars sound very similar to other webinars that are going on, and they're not doing enough to differentiate. So in terms of what you can do, the first one is to focus on the outcomes. So what outcomes are you going to offer people that are participating in your webinar? Why is your webinar worth their time? Because I think there's the one key thing about hosting events, whether it's in person and online, is that you have to respect the time of your participants, of your attendees. So why organize it in the first place? What are you going to offer them that is worth their time attending? And how are you communicating that? So there are lots of different ways of communicating. Don't just rely on what you say on that webinar signup page, because as marketers, we need to appeal to different types of learning, different types of consuming media. So if you can find different ways of communicating the same message, where that message is very clear, as to the benefits and the outcomes that they're going to get, then you're going to get more people signing up. And actually, I think that you're going to win, because there are a lot of companies out there that are, marketing webinars and events. There's a lot of overwhelm that's happening. A lot of feedback I'm getting is that we don't know which events to attend. We're being inundated with events. I host at least 3 webinars per month with my business and also with my clients. And I'm getting the best attendance rates that I've ever had. I think it's a huge opportunity, but you have to be very clear as to what outcomes you're offering.
Cool, thank you for that. We'll go to 2 more questions, but I ask the people answering to be to the point. John, this question from Joanne Greener. Joanne says, we're a small business who have furloughed our marketing person. As someone trying to pick this up, are there any free tools that you would recommend to help us be more agile and proactive?
I think the biggest one is Trello. So a lot of people use Trello. From an agile point of view, it's a great starting point. And essentially, think about, firstly, I think one of the first things to do when you're starting to adopt agile, and one thing to say quickly is, don't try and do everything at once. Take steps, but is really understanding and creating literally a master to-do list, or what we call a backlog. So try and include everything that you need to be doing within that, and then focus on how you prioritize it. Don't necessarily prioritize the whole thing, but just what's the top 10 or 20 things that you need to be doing in order. And then what you can do with Trello is essentially create a list with all of those. And then a very simple process is looking at, okay, what's in progress and what's been completed. So you can move things forward and just see where things are sitting in the different steps to getting things done.
And finally, John, Tim Parrock asks, it's obvious that the publishing world is going to be very different right now in terms of print, digital and video media. But what, and he doesn't say this, but I am quickly, what are your predictions for publishing and therefore advertising after lockdown?
So I think one of the biggest things, and this is kind of where my world comes in, which is I think there's a transition from kind of blanket approaches to media to much more specific. So that's where demand generation comes in, where we're focused away from creating one specific event, which is a lead capture, to taking users on a journey, and we're actually growing demand over time and then servicing that into our clients. So looking at it more holistically like that, but also looking at it more specifically in terms of discrete demand, rather than blanket approaches where you're, you know, going scattergun to try and you know, create, whether it's awareness or leads and things like that.
Thank you. And that's it. Thanks to our four brilliant speakers, to Lisa Daniels, to Charlie Wyman, to John Webb, and to Vernon Riley. Thanks to our brilliant backroom team of Louise Neal, Claire Sheriff, Josh Bench, and Jay Neal. And thanks to you for participating. Next Wednesday at 4:30 BST, we've got Omar Bono's chair, Fran Brosen. We've got brand and campaign marketing manager at S&P Global Platts, Helen McKenzie. We've got the CEO of ABM Business Radiate B2B, Riaz Kanani. And we've got B2B marketer Jay Ball. You can sign up now at businessmarketingclub.org.uk/events. You can listen again to this webinar from tomorrow, or you can listen to our weekly podcast this week on personalization, or you can get yourself a mentor to help you through the crisis. Details of all of that at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. You can contact me if you want at davestevensnow@gmail.com. That's it. Thanks so much for coming along. I hope you stay safe and have a nice evening. Take care. Bye-bye.